It's like waking up and you haven't got to have a drink. I mean, and that was a buzz in itself, you know?
Yeah.
God, I woke up, I'm buzzing, I'm clean, I can hear the birds. Do you know what I mean? But now I suppose it's the fact of no matter what I go through, no matter what I've gone through, and I still remain to probably have bouts of anxiety or bouts of depression, whatever I go through, I don't have to escape by using drinking drugs to cope with that. But there's still a part of you that you're striving, well, I am, I still strive because I want to be better. And I know that I know that I'm not the finished article. I know that I still have flaws. I know that I still struggle with consistency, you know, and that's been my journey.
Welcome to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefour. We are now into season 6, focusing on mental fitness in Britain's construction industry because historically, these working environments are not conducive to men being able to speak openly about mental health or well-being. And the stats currently stand that construction workers are nearly 4 times more likely to die from suicide than the national average. Sober now for nearly 19 years, our guest today is painter Paul. Originally from Essex, Paul is so articulate and speaks openly about his bouts with anxiety and the journey since understanding his OCD diagnosis. Paul speaks with generous honesty about his first career as a panel beater, later working as a train ticket collector, moving from photography with his own exhibition in London, then a cabbie, and now a painter and decorator. This is an important listen, particularly for those who know someone working in construction, either on a building site or as a sole trader. Paul, welcome to This Is Powerful, my friend.
Hello, mate. All right?
Yeah, I'm really good. Thanks for coming here.
No worries.
This is really important because we're doing a season on people in the construction industry, completely different trades. And I don't think too many people are talking about it. You know, we have a lot of professionals and other people on here and some celebrities and different people, but I really think it's important to hear about tradesmen, how you deal with stuff in life, mental well-being. Obviously, we're talking about addiction today. So, I'm excited to talk to you, mate.
Cheers, Paul. You too.
We, on this podcast, always go back to the beginning. So you don't have to go back to when you was like one, but if you can let our audience know like where you're from, Paul, and kind of how your upbringing was.
Yeah, I'm from Barking originally. My upbringing was 2 lovely parents. I had a brother. Indoors, they was good as gold. Dad was always working. We was just given everything we wanted. Brought up really well. Come from quite a big family. But yeah, I had nothing there with my mum and dad, but I suppose that I was the black sheep in that family.
You?
Yeah. Yeah, I was, yeah.
What makes you say that?
Because my brother was more level-headed. My dad and my mum were level-headed, and I just always felt diseased with everything, you know. I was always striving attention. I was always striving something. I was riddled with anxieties, even from a child.
Do you know that then, Paul? Is that in hindsight?
It's in hindsight. I knew that things used to speed up really, really fast when I was a kid. And I used to say to my mum, something's going on. And I'm only been about 7 or 8. Something's going on here. Everything going really, really fast. And I just put that down to now that was anxiety. You know,
what did your mum say? Because she's probably not very well equipped to
pull yourself together.
Really?
Yeah.
Fair.
It's nothing wrong with you. No, I'll tell you what she did do. Can't have Coke. Can't have chocolate.
Well,
it's the E numbers.
That was smart of her.
Yeah, it was the E numbers that made you like that. But I just was wired differently. You know, thought everything was funny. And there was a deep-rooted insecurity within me that I had to be extrovert to feel like I could fit in.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't feel like I fitted in. I felt less than.
How did that affect you? Because I actually can identify with that. I I did actually, it's funny, I used to say to my mum about, I think I've got adrenaline problems. Mm. And it was probably around 8 as well. Because I was just, it was like, just wind me up and I go. I couldn't sit still. I'd be doing like handstands, running up and down the garden. Mm. I remember I wasn't that young. I was at a bus stop and a friend drove past with her parents and stopped and said, am I okay? Because I was doing chin-ups at a bus stop. So I just couldn't sit still. I mean, I was really fit because of that.
Mm.
But there was definitely something going on.
Mm. Yeah, that's how I was, to be honest with you. That's how I was really up to, I suppose, 8 or 9. And then something happened from then. And then that sort of, into adolescence, really sort of messed me up a little bit more, what with the anxiety and everything, you know. And it was like I had this secret I didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And that sort of played into it. So I'd become then more extrovert to hide this deep-rooted insecurity about me.
Mm. Which is actually an intelligent survival skill for a young person.
Mm. At the time, you don't feel like you're... Do you know what I mean? When you're young, you don't know. You're just going through it and this and that. And then what happened then was... I would start lying to create this persona of this person that wasn't enough, that felt like he wasn't enough.
It's kind of what the media do. They're like, look over there, look at this stuff while real things go on over here, right? So it's a good diversion tactic, even if you don't feel like it was when you're younger.
And it was like some of the stuff that I come out with and lied, it was like, it's ridiculous. It was ridiculous, but it was... I suppose I lied because I wanted to be somebody. I wanted people to think he's all right, he is. Even knowing that I was all right, you know. But I just wanted, it was like I just needed that extra approval.
A lot of people who have addiction problems and other people who have ADHD and different diagnoses talk about low self-worth. And I think it might be hard to understand what it is unless you've experienced it. How would you describe someone what low self-worth is?
My low self-worth was basically not thinking I'm good enough, thinking I'm the worst person that could possibly be. I'm not going to amount to anything. Never going to go anywhere in life, not going to do anything, not have no drive.
It's like an internal narrative that you have to listen to all the time, right?
Yeah, and it was all the time, constantly. Yeah. You're this, you're that, you're a load of rubbish, you're that, you know, and then trying to, as time was going on in school, and I would just, like, fulfil that thought because I never had no exam qualifications. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't study. I just thought everything was a joke, everything was a laugh.
Hmm.
And I remember my old man, my dad saying to me, you want to knuckle down, mate, because you're going to end up in a dead-end job. And I thought, what do you know? What do you know? You're an old man.
I bet he was probably only about 40 at the time.
Yeah, he was. Younger than me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But you just think to yourself, like, I think about some of the things he said, and I think, you know what, you was right. You was right, Dad. And you're just coming from that place of love and care, knowing that that's what you've done in your life.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because he don't want to see his son probably go down the same path, and he wants to see his son have a better life.
It's really hard because there's two worlds, there's the outside world and the inside world.
Mm. And they don't line up.
They don't line up.
No.
And I think it's hard. I don't personally know what the right path would be, but whether there's talks to younger people to explain that, because I've never heard of people talk about it. They might do now in school. I don't know. But that's a big disconnect, anyone's internal dialogue to external.
Mm.
And I think most people have it.
Mm.
You know, I know in the fashion industry, there's a lot of people that have great personas and they're really fabulous, or they're very catty or clicky and they look very powerful. But actually, on their own, when you talk to them, they're in bits.
Yeah.
And it's usually the one that's showing so much.
Yeah.
You know, how is that in... So you're a painter and decorator now?
Yeah, right? I am now, yeah.
How is that in that industry? Do you see that a lot, Paul?
I talked to a few painter and decorators, and I suppose my issues of what I had when I was a child, I still like that today, but not to that extent. You know, I get massively imposter syndrome. I get that. Every job that I do, I feel I'm not good enough at.
Just for the record, I've seen your work and it's bloody brilliant.
Thanks, Paul.
No, genuinely.
Cheers.
Yeah.
Do you know what? It's because of social media and a lot of painter decorators I follow, you look at their work on social media and you think that's amazing, yeah? And you're putting yourself under that bracket. You're trying to better yourself and to do this. And every job that I do, even though that it looks great and I'm happy with it and the client's happy with it, there's a part of me that thinks, well, it's not as good as then. You know, it's not as good as then.
Being in the creative world for years, though, I hear that from writers, artists, actors. And in a way, that's almost a plus, because you're not going to just put your boots up and hang up and go, oh, that's fine, and walk away. You're going to do better and do good and do better. That's kind of a, in a way, it's a good drive, right?
Yeah, even though, of course, because you're trying to, you want perfection. Well, I want perfection, and I'm never going to get perfection. I want 100% approval, guarantee, and perfection with everything I do, and I'm not going to get it.
Yeah.
And that to me is like, we go back to when I was younger, and it's like you've got this stuff going in your head, and it's like 100% I need guarantee that this will not happen, and you can't guarantee this stuff's going to not happen. And then that would trigger off some sort of anxiety in me that I need to know.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Well, you're not going to need to know. You better get comfortable with that, because there's no guarantee whatever you're thinking is going to happen. And you could go to work, you know, and everything could go wrong on the job. Or you think it's a great job, you come home and the person phones you up, you've missed a bit. Oh, no. And that is my work. That, for me, when that's happened, you come back, oh, there's a little bit missed. And that, for me, my head goes straight away and I think, well, that's it.
As long as it's not a whole wall.
Yeah, exactly. Whole house. I painted the neighbour's house. But it's, I think with my work now, I enjoy what I do, you know. There is a creative side to it. I am quite good at painting. I do enjoy what I do, you know.
When you left school, what did you do? Where did you go?
When I left school, I had no idea what I was going to do. And then my mum said to me, don't come home till you get a job. So I was like, okay. And back then you could get a job.
Yeah.
So I ended up on a YTS on a panel beater and spraying cars.
Did you really?
Yeah, sitting guilds. And it was the first exam I ever passed, because I thought to myself, I've never done anything in school. And I didn't really want to do it. It was a time when I left school in 88, 89, so it was that scene, the club scene, it was all coming around, and that sort of took over that from there.
When did you first have a drink or a substance?
I suppose I was probably about 13, 14, I'd had a puff. And
was that because, like, people around you were puffing?
Yeah,
or you?
Yeah.
And was there any conversation before it? Like,
no.
I remember when it was young, when I had friends, and they're like, yeah, no, it makes you feel relaxed. It makes you feel like this. So there was an enticement that you could feel different. Did they?
Thinking about it, yeah, because some people could take it, but when I'd done it, I just got instant paranoia and hated it and thought everybody was talking about me. Everybody's looking at me like I'm, like I've got three eyes or something like that. Do you know what I mean? It was. I just did not like it. The puff did not agree with me. That was more of a downer. And then we got into the speed and the rave scene, the drug, the ecstasy and all that, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a time when it was amazing.
That was a good period.
Brilliant.
I think it was like 88 really, it kind of took off, didn't it?
Mm.
You had a lot of music come out of Chicago, and then Ibiza started. And I feel like in my life that was a good period.
Very good.
it was fun.
Yeah, it was fun.
At the time, not to sell what it was, but it was, alcohol went down, ecstasy went up, and there was less violence and more fun, and actually a lot of loving between guys and girls, and it was like quite a free period, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the beauty of that was you'd go out, there was no mobile phones, everyone was in the moment, The music was the thing that everybody loved. People wasn't drinking beer, they were drinking water. And everybody was just in that moment, loving each other. And it was untouchable.
Yeah.
It really was a great period.
It was funny because I was trying to explain to someone the other day that we didn't have phones. So you'd turn on a radio station on a Friday night and they would tell you what gas station to be at with like a BMW with a flag on it or like a Capri with a flag on it. Just follow that car.
Yeah, and it's like, it was like
100 cars turn up at a petrol garage and just follow it to a rave. Yeah,
it was mad. We had one of my mates had a Volkswagen Beetle and we was all sitting in the thing driving the thing. We had like, it was back in the day with curtains and all the rave music. It was just great.
Yeah.
It was great. And I know the music's evolved since then, but the kids today, they don't have that. You know, they have their form of that, but their form of that is totally different to us.
Well, you can see online when you see a video of back in the 80s in a club, everyone's dancing, and now you just see everyone videoing, other people videoing, dancing.
Yeah.
So it's like you're removed, you're kind of not experiencing it, right?
You're not in the moment at all.
Yeah.
And then I just say, oh, it was a great night. Look at this video, I videoed someone dancing, what a great night. But I'm so glad there's no videos of when I was out.
Well, you're a bad dancer.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, really, really bad. Yeah, that was a good one, yeah.
So you went, so you was panel beating, and then when the rave scene was doing, what was you doing then?
I was a guard on the Liverpool Street line.
Was you really?
Yeah, I was a guard on the Liverpool Street line, and I've done it for 2 years, and then they was doing, I hated it because I had to do tickets, and there was many a time where it was almost every weekend, every weekend I would come out of a club. And then I'd have to go to work and I'd open the back door and I'd have to say, tickets please, mate. And I was out of my head.
Seriously?
Yeah, I was out of my head and I hated it.
Did they know? Did anyone know?
I don't know. And the thing was, I remember going up to one bloke and I thought, oh, look at you, mate. You look like an absolute head case. And I'm saying tickets. And he said, I ain't got one. And I was going, all right, no worries, mate. I thought, I'm not getting involved. And then they was doing on the spot random drug tests. And I thought, I'm going. Because I'm like, I can't get sacked. So there was a thing of offering redundancy because they was changing from British Rail to, I think it was East London or something like that. So I said, I took the redundancy and got out of that one.
Blimey. And then what did you do?
And then it was really just like a lost cause, you know, window cleaning, film extra work, that sort of stuff.
Did you do film extra work?
Yeah, done a few.
What did you do?
I was in EastEnders a few times, The Bill. I had to do not on your caliber, Paul, but I had to do a catwalk in Stratford Town Hall.
Oh my God, have they got a video of this catwalk?
No, I hope they don't. It's nothing like you, but I just had to do it for this wedding, all this wedding stuff, and it was a good experience, do you know what I mean?
But were you lost as a person then? So you're just doing something to get money in and hope that maybe you'll like it or...
Yeah, hope that I like it. I hope that I'll break into something or I hope that you'll get caught or you'll get someone to say, oh, he's really good. Or do you know what I mean? Just hope that there will be a break.
Yeah.
That's really what I thought in my mind would happen. And I was just delusional, to be honest with you. I'd like to call it delusional, stuck in that... child survival mode, thinking that from escape, you know, you're going to just whatever and get found and everything's going to be great. And
it's really weird. Living in America, someone would reframe that into putting yourself in a position to get spotted, to make it.
Right.
It's funny, isn't it? So it's like, it's the same process of different mindset. And I think, you know, I know you've done a lot of work on yourself and I think, when you have a hyper awareness, it's interesting to see how it can.
Yeah, just you turning that around and explaining that, it made me think, well, yeah, you was.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're putting yourself out there.
Yeah, exactly. You're putting yourself in the way. But because that's what people do. If you're an actor, you need to go and do loads of stuff to try and get spotted by a director that's like, he's got talent, let's bring him in. Or someone who's singing. That's why all the talent shows work, because you're putting yourself in a place to get spotted.
Yeah. But then that goes on with everything, because later on in life, I ended up doing a degree in photography. And then from that, I thought I was like the next Herb Ritz, do you know what I mean? And I'd walk about my camera all day long, and I had a couple of exhibitions, and in my head, instead of just enjoying it for what it was, you know, enjoying it for documentary street-style photography,
yeah,
and having this exhibition, in my head, it was, you're going to sell everything. You're going to sell everything. You're going to become famous. You're going to become rich. Someone's going to want to buy this stuff. And that didn't happen.
But you had an exhibition or two exhibitions?
Two exhibitions.
Where were they?
Just in Brick Lane.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. One was on based on street photography, based on Truman's Brewery, because my dad worked at Truman's and my granddad worked at Truman's. And it was all based on that sort of documenting how it was in the 60s to how it is now, you know?
Wow.
And
yeah, do you still have the collection of photographs?
Yeah, I've got some. Yeah, they're in the loft, yeah. But I, just to be honest with you, I don't really know what happened. I went to India and started documenting street shop owners and places where people had died, and with all like shrines where people had put stuff down. And then I came back and, yeah, I never picked a camera up again.
When was that?
2013.
Wow. Why did you not pick it up again?
I don't know. I just went, no, don't do it now. It was like a Forrest Gump moment. You know when he runs?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, I think I stopped now. And I think I stopped, because I don't know how far to take it, you know?
Is that correlated to money and career? So in other words, because it takes bloody lot of work to get a hook, to get something. But you already did two exhibitions, which is massive anyway, because there's so many people to take photographs and they won't go anywhere, and some of them are really good.
Mm.
Do you think if someone had sort of spotted you or said, okay, I like what you're doing, carry on and we can do something else?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. But because nothing ever come of it, and then in the end of it, you're like looking at your own photos and liking your own work, and then I just thought, no, let's do something different. And then the opportunity to paint come along. And that was really just, that came out of the back of me being suicidal.
What was going on before then, Paul, for you to get to that place?
I'd stopped taking my medication. And I had that thought, I'm okay, I don't need it. So I stopped taking it.
Do you mind me asking what the medication was?
Prozac. So I stopped taking it. And I was fine for a week, but because they've got a long half-life on them, the second week was quite bad. And when it got into the third week, I was climbing the walls. I was suicidal, I was so anxious and stressed out.
Was that originally for anxiety?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was diagnosed in 1998 in the old Worley Mental Hospital. And yeah, and I'd come a long way from then, you know, but I mean, I still have it now. Like, I'll probably have one or two little mini breakdowns a year.
What would you class as a mini breakdown?
Can't cope.
Right.
You know, can't cope. But by having people around me and having a program and having a phone, and being able to talk to people and be open and be honest of where I'm at, it does help.
Mm.
Where turn the clock back to 1998, there was none of that. And in 1998, I was, yeah. I think if I didn't take Prozac, I wouldn't be here.
Hi, it's Paul here. I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you and to say if you've heard something on the show that's moved you, please follow, rate or review the show. And it'd be amazing if you could share it. Now back to the show. From the rave scene, for a lot of people that went into about 94, stretching at 95, what was your drinking and drug taking like up prior to that period in 98?
98, it wasn't. To be honest with you, I was drinking. Might have been having a a line of coke every now and again, but it wasn't all the time. You know, I was drinking and I was training to be a black cab driver then. So I couldn't do anything because I thought this is what I've got to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I lived that religiously for just over 2 years and then got the knowledge.
That's quick.
Yeah. And really the weird thing was, you know, when the people say like they, you manifest stuff. Well, it was really weird. Well, the first day I started the knowledge, I bought a board, put the big map on the board, got all my runs out, they bought me bike. That was the... I loved it, the bike, do you know what I mean? But in my mind, when I say a bike, it was like an Harley Davidson, but it was an Honda Cub 90. I looked like Olive out of Off the Buses with a pair of goggles.
Which is a brilliant bike, by the way.
Oh, I loved it.
I'd like one of them now, actually.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. But, yeah, so I've got this board, and I wrote on the board... Christmas 1999, and I started in September 1997, and I put down Christmas 1999, and I got my badge on the 22nd of December 1999.
Wow, you got to be smart. it's one of the only careers where they can physically measure how many neurons you grow in a short period of time.
Really?
Yes, it's incredible. It's one of the only things where cab drivers where their brain actually grows so much.
Right.
Because you've got to learn, what is it, 8,000 runs, something nuts, 8,000 roads?
I think it's 20,000 roads. You've got to learn places of interest, points, hotels, restaurants, theatres. And looking back now, it fed into the person I am, obsessive.
Mm.
So I loved it, you know.
But that's a nice period then, because...
Yeah.
You're putting all your energy into something which is actually growing your brain and learning, and at the end of it is a big win.
Yeah. And the funny thing was, when I went for my first talk, there was 20 people in the room, and the bloke said, out of 20 people, he said, two of you is going to pass. He said, some of you give up, three or four of you will split up with your missus, two of you will have a mental breakdown, and one of you will die.
Wow.
On a bike. He said, but two of you will... pass out, and everything happened to me other than dying. Do you know what I mean? Split up with a wife, mental breakdown, everything. And I think what happened was the fact that because it became obsessive and it became to the point and it was religiously every day feeding, going through what you got to do, it then opened whatever it opened in my mind. I didn't realise at the time, but I was suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder, and it fed completely into that.
Right. So was that, when you have that, just so people understand that, does that mean it's like you're firing on all cylinders, everything's great and everything's fine whilst you're learning it, and then that stops?
Yeah, what happened was I was learning it and it became an obsession. And then one day in the cab, I can just put it down to, I'd like to say it was, now I know it as panic, but a thought entered my mind. A thought came in my mind. And the thought created so much anxiety. And because it had created so much anxiety, I thought the thought was real.
Mm.
And then it created more anxiety, like a second whoosh of fear. And then I could not get that thought out of my head for a year. And it was 24 hours a day, that thought. And the thought was, you're gay. That's what the thought was. And I struggled bad. Because I thought, I know I'm not. And your brain's saying you are. What if? What if? And it goes back to what I said about, I was looking, I need to know 100%.
Yeah.
There's no 100%. You either are or you're not. You can't be a little bit. You either are or you're not. Mm. I knew I wasn't, but my mind is telling me I am, which created this massive anxiety.
Mm.
And and then the theme changed. It went from being gay then to you're a paedophile. That was the hardest one. Then to you're a serial killer. And that's when it led me down to Worley Mental Hospital. I didn't know where I was coming or going. you know. My parents didn't know what was going on. And for the bloke to sit down and tell me that you've got, he said, you've got OCD. And I said to him, oh, I'm not having that. I said, that's for people who are all clean and touch the gaslight and all that. And he said, that's one part of it. He said, but, he said, how long, how often are you thinking about these obsessions? I said, what do you mean? He said, an hour. I said, but from the minute I open my eyes to the minute I close my eyes. He said, so 18 hours a day. I said, yeah. He said, and what you're doing in that 18 hours? I said, I'm riddled with anxiety and I'm looking for an answer. I said, I'm scanning my mind and everything. He said, yeah. He said, it's classic OCD.
Wow.
So, but then there was a relief in the fact that I had a label and then I needed to go and do something about that. So I joined the World OCD Convention that was in exhibition mode.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and listened to likewise people like myself to get some sort of understanding, you know.
And did that give you understanding?
It gave me an understanding because the man that opened it up, he said some stuff about suicide and all this, and I thought to myself, I get it. Then I joined the OCD charity, which is in Highbury, and then they spoke about BDD, body dysmorphic disorder, and I thought, well, I've had that all my life.
Mm.
And then we spoke about that. So I thought, and then I felt at ease knowing that this is actually a problem, but you can talk about this problem to these people. Where I couldn't talk about it to my friends. Well, my friends would say, what's the matter? You can't say, well, I've got my head telling me I'm going to go and kill someone.
Yeah.
And they're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So yeah. It was...
That's the problem with stuff, isn't it? Is that... If you have nowhere to share, and or you're too scared to, or you're too ashamed to, or your mind's telling you that you shouldn't, so keep it in, the pressure must be unbelievable.
Yeah. The pressure, but do you know what? There was a time when, I feel really, really sorry for people today, right, in the fact of the mental health facilities are not really there, right, and I think I was probably one of the last dying breed that went to Worley. But being in the construction, you know, if you're suffering from intrusive thoughts, paranoia, depersonalization, derealization, you know, if you're suffering from all these things and you've got nobody to talk to and your head's telling you that you're a paedophile or your head's telling you this, even though you know you're not, you can't go and tell people that, you know. So that's why probably people end up topping themselves.
Well, what's the stats in the construction?
The stats are that there's two people a day in the construction that will kill themselves.
In the UK?
In the UK, two people a day are going to work in the morning and not coming home overnight for whatever reason, you know.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's really bad. And that's why you've got the other part of, say, what I said earlier, you've got mental health awareness, you know, and that's great for social media, hashtag mental health awareness, and oh, brilliant. But the fact of actually sitting there talking to somebody, you know, and just trying to say, this is how I'm feeling. You know, there's a woman called, you might know her, Rosie Cartwright.
No.
Well, she wrote a programme for Channel 4 called Pure. And it made me cry. Because I thought it was the first time someone had depicted what it's like. And I thought, my God. And it took me right back to a time where I was hopeless.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? And it sort of raised awareness in a dark humour sort of way, you know? And then there was another, Susan Jeffries, who wrote a book, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway.
Mm.
I mean, I read that when I was at my worst. But I was petrified because it said on the front cover, feel the fear and do it anyway. And I'm thinking, well, I can't do that. Do you know what I mean? So it's just getting an understanding and awareness. And it's took me, how old am I now? 53. It's took me like 25 years to come to terms with this. But on the other side of that, the drinking and the drug taking, that's when it really, really took off.
Do you think that the drinking and drug taking was... medicating, like when you was younger, to try and be someone else. Do you think that's what it was?
Yeah.
When did you realise that drinking drugs were taking hold?
probably around about 30. I was probably about 30.
Had you stopped cabbing at that point? Or
no, I was still cabbing. Yeah, I was still cabbing. And realistically, I was going to work hungover every day. You know, hungover every day. It wasn't good. Getting involved in arguments with people. It's just a sad life, really.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? But not thinking that I was the problem. You know, and then it got to a point, I think I was 32, and my missus had had enough of me. And I still didn't think I was doing anything wrong. I really didn't. And I was bought into this whole victim mode. If you had this said, you'd drink like this. If you had this said, you'd use drugs like this. And I'm a secret artist. And, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm a troubled person, like Van Gogh. Do you know what I mean?
Didn't you see my exhibition?
Yeah, at one stage I was thinking to myself, if I cut my ear off, does that mean like you're just mad?
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it carried on. We went to France, and that was just the worst. We don't even talk about France indoors, you know. If Paris comes on the TV, my missus looks at me in absolute shock, and she's like, let's not talk about it. And it was bad, you know. Because I was just full flight from reality with drinking and taking coke. And then when we came back, she'd had enough. And then that was the wake-up call, you know.
What did you do about it? Was you like, okay, I need to...
Well, I went to a meeting a year previous. So I went to a meeting in 2006, and I sat in this meeting and I looked about and I thought, you've got to be joking. I ain't like these, no way. You know, and I went down to the pub the next day, as you do. I went to a meeting last night with my mates, and they went, okay. So I said, oh, this is easy, I'll do it. I said, a lemonade, please. They went, all right, lemonade. And I thought, don't be like that. So I'll have a shandy, please. A pint of shandy. I thought, that still tastes of lemonade. I'll have a lager top, please. Lager top, a little bit of lemonade. Can I have a lager, please? That's four drinks in. I know what I do. I make the phone call, got the gear. And then I was out there for another year. And that year then got bad. And then my last night out, my missus just said, when you come back, I'm not here. And halfway through the night, nothing was working. It wasn't getting rid of anxiety. It wasn't doing this. It was just, I just felt dead. I just wanted to die. And then my last night out, that was it. A thought come in my mind, bang, it just come in my mind and just said, you're done. And that was the change. That was the change. And that's when I started going to meetings.
And how long ago was that, Paul?
27th of November 2007, I started. Yeah.
And you've been sober since?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been a long time. It's been a journey, a massive journey of discovery about yourself, about myself. And in that time, obviously working and trying to do the right thing and not getting it right, you know. And what I honestly thought was when I came in recovery, I thought it's going to be like linear. I'm going to go from there, rocket into this new level. I'm going to have, when they said, like they say, a life beyond your wildest dreams, I thought to myself, oh, that's it. I'm going to have nice cars, boat. Still ain't got a nice car. I've never got a boat. Do you know what I mean? But what I do have is an understanding of me. You know, I've got a great family around me, a great missus who's supportive around me. Especially when I was changing careers, you know, from being a cab driver to being a painter and decorator. She was there, knew that it was the right thing for me to do. That was the old me. And now this is going into the new me, you know. And it's been a journey. It really has.
What's been the best thing about it?
Firstly, it was like waking up and you haven't got to have a drink. And that was a buzz in itself, you know.
Yeah.
God, I woke up, I'm buzzing, I'm clean, I can hear the birds. Do you know what I mean? But now I suppose it's the fact of no matter what I go through, no matter what I've gone through, and I still remain to probably have bouts of anxiety or bouts of depression, whatever I go through, I don't have to escape by using drink and drugs to cope with that.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
There's probably millions of people that still do and can't do that. And I think, you know, I've been in sobriety for quite some time, and sometimes I can take that for granted. What you said before is amazing. When you think that you get excited about hearing the birds in the morning, the sunshine come up, right? That is pure gratitude because you must have been in such a dark place to actually recognise the birds in the morning and take it on board. And to do that and then carry on growing is no mean feat. It's like, it's pretty incredible. I think we can take that for granted, you know, because when you, if you look on paper, what you've changed, what you've turned around, how many people you've helped, you've got a very successful business, do really well, it actually looks like it's really great, right?
Yeah. But there's still a part of you that you're striving, well, I am, I still strive because I want to be better. And I know that I'm not the finished article. I know that I still have flaws. I know that I still struggle with consistency, you know. Consistency of going to work is not a problem. But the consistency of trying to do this stuff to better me, you know, of waking up in the morning, trying to meditate, trying to just get in that zone, you know what I mean? My consistency with that is I do it, I feel good, I'll stop doing it. I do it, I feel good, I'll stop doing it. And that's been my journey, you know. And to make time for myself in the morning, sometimes it's quite difficult when you've got a couple of dogs, you know what I mean, and you're trying to have a little peaceful 5 minutes and then the dogs are barking and they're coming up and you just think, oh, mate. But
this is important because this is reality.
Yeah.
Right, I remember looking after someone when I was still modelling. And I'm like, just meditate in the morning. I was given advice to do, and he had 4 kids, dogs. You know, I now have a family and stuff, and it's not easy.
No.
It's not easy, but it's not being put in the drawer and gone, I can't deal with it, I'm not doing that.
No,
it's
no.
still there.
Yeah.
And I think that in itself's amazing. You know, you see a lot of people on Instagram online, like on their yacht or in their big villa in Spain or wherever, saying, yeah, I'm having a papaya juice before I meditate, and then I'm going to stand on my head for it. It's not reality for everybody.
No.
It's life's busy, and if you can commit to yourself to do 5 minutes a day, that's good.
Mm.
We don't all have millions of pounds to go and, you know, have our personal trainer fly around with us.
Mm.
And it's important to know that, yeah, sure, you might be living wherever, with a busy family and noise around you, but if you can commit to that 5 minutes, that's massive. That's big. And you don't have to do it in a Lululemon outfit.
No.
I can sit down and do it in your boxer shorts, whatever. You know, I think that needs to be said because this whole thing you can see online, it's like, you know, candles and music. No, it doesn't. You can just do it in a toilet if you need to. You
know? There's many a times that I've gone and I woke up and I think, oh, bloody hell, I forgot to pray or whatever, you know. And then I'm in the bath, and I'm starting praying, you know, or I put the Spotify on and I'm listening to meditation, or I put Insight Timer on. Like last night, it's meditation, I was tired last night and I put the meditation timer and I'm thinking, right, let's have a look what one we look. And if someone could see you, right, if someone could see you and they'd think, what is he doing? Do you know what I mean? And it was like, right, here we go, 2 hours sleep, positive affirmations. And I'm lying there and the woman's going, you are amazing. And I'm lying there, and it's like, that goes in, though, to the subconscious.
Yeah.
I have to hear that, you know, because for too long I've heard, you are crap, you are this, you can't do that. So when a woman says, you are amazing, and you know, it's just that thing that you can go asleep to, and knowing that your subconscious is still awake, is still listening to that.
Yeah.
And I try to do that, you know. I try to do that every night with that one there.
Yeah. But and you know what? You can laugh at that, but it's actually, I listened to Eckhart Tolle for a year and a half, God, back in 2000, maybe 6 or 7, because I couldn't sleep because my subconscious was saying, what are you doing?
Mm.
You know, I was early sobriety, full of fear, still anxiety. I'd moved back to LA. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was just trying to survive, really, and get back into my industry and stuff. Mm. And my brain was giving me a hard time. So every night I listened to it. It was CD back then, and I just listened to it. I told her I'd wake up now and then and put it back on,
mm.
because I knew that my self-talk at the time was so negative, mm. it was going to cause some serious problems.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really smart thing to do, because you are rewriting the subconscious.
Mm.
You're listening to something kind, right?
Mm.
So you can sleep, get up, go to work, do a good day's work, and then come home and be responsible with the family.
Mm. Yeah, there's been many a times I pulled it. It's like, when it's been on me and I don't want to go to work, but I've had to go to work.
Mm.
And then I have to laugh because the client thinks I'm painting upstairs in the bedroom, but what I'm actually doing is hiding behind their wardrobe, praying or meditating,
yeah.
just to get some sort of, or talking to somebody or listening to a podcast, you know, listening to something. Like, I'd done this one job once and I was listening to 80s music, and then the next day I woke up, I felt terrible. And then I'm having a podcast on about mental health, and the people downstairs must have thought, who is this bloke, mate? He's gone from listening to like Duran Duran to it's like,
yeah,
obsessive stuff, you know what I mean? But it's anything that I need to do to get through.
But that's the point. You still do. You complete the job. You do a really good job. You do your stuff.
Mm.
It doesn't matter, because we had someone do some work for us a long time ago, and bless him, he started off really good, but I could see on day 3 something had changed. His behaviour had changed. People come in to drop stuff off, and I don't know what he was taking, but day 6, I was like, mate, you need to go.
Mm.
Like, if there's anything you want to talk about, please do, but you need to go. It was insane.
Yeah, it's just
and
sad,
I could see this guy was coping, and I said to him, look, if you want to talk about something, that's fine, but you are in my house and my kids will be around later, so you know,
mm.
you can't be here.
Mm.
And he knew, and he was fine. I paid him for what he'd done, and he left. What would you say to people, Paul, on that are on building sites and stuff? Because it is, I remember I did suspended ceilings when I was about 16, 17, and it was hard. Like, people were fucking locking people in cupboards. I remember fucking someone was on the scaffold, someone drilled a jit rock through my shoe thinking it was funny, it went into my foot. And like, it was crazy stuff going on. I mean, I did work with some mad people. I mean, like, seriously mad people. And it became the norm. Like, mm. it's quite, like, mad stuff, but I remember saying to the guy I worked for at the time, there was two guys. One was definitely unwell, and the other one was a nice guy. And I said to this guy, Keith, I said, I won't mention his name, the other guy talked to me like that. I said, we're going to Leeds to do a job for 4 or 5 days, and I need to know I'm safe with him. So the guy phoned me up and said, listen, I'm sorry about my behaviour. I'll be totally sold me this lie. Got in the van the next day, and then he attacked me as soon as I got in the van. Literally attacked me, and he's like, oh, I'm going to do you little sod. You've got 4 days, you're going to stay in my room with me. And I was like that. I was like, oh my God, what is going on? And that's the response to voicing I need to be treated differently.
Yeah, yeah.
It was insane. Like, it was actually, I'll tell you privately, whatever, it was completely nuts. How is it at the moment working on sites?
I would say, if you think about it, that there is a laugh, there is a banter, and people have to get through whatever they do by whatever means, you know. But not everybody is the same, are they? So if mental health affects 1 in 4, then one person out of that 4 people are not going to take things well.
Mm.
You know, by whatever reason, if they're an addict, an alcoholic, mental, whatever it is. So they're going home and they're stressing and they're worrying about what's going on for today. Like what you just said, don't talk to me like that, you know. But to these other people, they're not, it's a joke to them. It's all fun and games. So come on. So we can't, you know, you have to be, I think, sympathetic. Is that the right word? Sympathetic. You have to be open to not everybody is the same and have an empathy around these people, you know. And the hardest part about it is what we said. If it comes down to mouths on a building site, they cannot open up because of this bravado. Men don't cry. Men don't show their feelings. Men don't do this, you know. And that might have been the generation in our father's generation, definitely in our granddad's generation, you know, who was in the war, never spoke about it, was shell-shocked, whatever, see all this stuff, and never spoke about it. Classic signs of PTSD, no help, you know. And we're meant to be the same, you know, this male thing. But we're not all like that. You don't know what's gone on in someone's life. What traumas someone's had, if he's been abused, if his parents have died, if whatever's gone on, he's carrying a lot of weight. You know, so they go on the building site and then they're joking, and when they're isolating, because if you're not on the site and you are a painter and decorator or you're a builder and you're working on your own, it's a lonely job. It can be lonely, you know, and if all you've got to contend with is your faults, and you know, you've got to make some sort of peace with yourself. You know, because them faults are coming no matter what. You know, and if you've not tried to make peace with yourself or have a bit of an understanding of know what you're from, they're going to be negative. You know,
what would you say to some? What would you suggest they do if they are feeling like that, whether they be working on their own or they're working in a group?
Well, I would say talk to someone. If you can't talk to people at work, talk to your partner, talk to closest people around you. You know, don't suffer in silence. Don't suffer in silence, you know. And also, you find a lot of people then escape through the drink and drugs. And that's great when you're drinking and when you're drugging and everything's a joke and everything's a laugh. But that morning when you come down and you're waking up, your depression and everything is 10 times worse. And then you're in that perpetual cycle. Oh my God, you know, I've got to have another drink. I've got to get rid of this anxiety. And the drink takes away the fear. So then you start becoming this, you're chasing that elusive thing. You don't want to feel like that. You know, but so my answer would be talk to people, you know. This is a day and age where we can't...
Well, there's more people talking about stuff now than there ever has been.
Yeah.
There's also people saying stuff that shouldn't. Like, you know, we touched on earlier, people saying, oh, that's my OCD. It's not your OCD because you don't have it.
No, exactly. No, exactly. I mean, I'll just give you an example. When I had it, I was housebound. For fear of going to kill someone. And looking back now, I find it sad because I've wasted so much time on looking for the 100% absolutes that I'm not going to do this and I'm not going to do that. And there is no 100% absolutes, you know? I'd like to think I wouldn't do this. I'd like to think I wouldn't do whatever's in my mind. And do you know what? The mind comes up with 60,000 thoughts a day, supposedly. You know, and you're harping on one of them. So you can't stop this, you know? It's like when I first started meditating, I went to a transcendental meditation course in South London. I thought, this is going to be amazing. But it was that instant I wanted it then. I didn't realise, hold up, I've got to do this every day. Do you know what I mean? The bloke was talking to me and he even said, you're not going to quieten the mind. He said, it's just about being aware of the stuff that comes in and paying no attention to it. You know, as soon as you put emphasis on whatever comes in your mind, that's when I create a problem. You know what I mean? If you just be aware and think, why did I think that? Go. Not come in and go.
And how do you, and is that where you're at? You can do that?
No. No, I've tried to do that.
If you've got 64,000 thoughts coming in, and you're sitting here telling your story, you are doing it on a level.
Then there must be on a level then, yeah. because the thoughts that come in 90%, 95%, well, they're all rubbish. Let's be honest about it. All the thoughts that come in my
most
mind.
Most of the negative thoughts, and I think something like 70 or 80% are repetitive anyway.
Yeah.
It's just how the machine works.
And I think that's the thing, the repetitive thoughts. But then when it comes into a thought, what I said about work, and you might think, that's not good enough. That's when I'll start going down that rabbit hole, you know? Or a classic thing for me is, and I don't ever realise it until it's passed, is the anxiety. Once I'm in that loop and I'm checking, you know, once I get then go down that rabbit hole and I'm Googling, why do I feel like this? Expecting Google to say, well, Paul, out of 50 billion people, you're feeling like this because, you know, it's just a generic thing.
Yeah.
And I'm putting that to me. Do you know what I mean? And then I keep... So, and then when I come out of it, I think, that was anxiety again.
Yeah.
That was anxiety. I just spent 2 weeks in an anxiety loop. Right, let's go again.
But it's amazing that A, it's only 2 weeks.
Mm.
B, you can see that. Because you said the other thoughts lasted a year.
Mm.
You can see that, get over that. You can share it, which is helping other people.
Mm.
Right? You work a great program for alcohol and drugs you don't use on it anymore.
Mm.
And it's probably hard to see how far you come.
Because
it's quite inspirational. Because like you said, there's two people in your industry dying every day from suicide. Mm. That is unbelievable.
It's sad.
It's bad. It's sad. Yeah. But it's, you know, like on our on Stride Foundation website, we put numbers on there for people just to phone to go, to know where to go, just as an information thing. Because I had no idea where to go when I had drink and drug problems.
Mm.
It's only because I read about a rehab, that's where I knew to go.
Mm.
It's still a crazy thing. That's why we put everything on this podcast. Mm. Paul, we're finished, mate. Very quick. And do you know what? Thank you so much for your honesty, mate. I think that's going to really help.
Cheers, Paul.
Some people. Cheers,
thanks,
mate.
Mate.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation, which educates children about addiction through school talks and provide some basic support for those struggling with addiction. To find out more what we do, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com. You can also donate, please donate. It will help us to break the stigma of addiction, it will help us to educate more young people, and it will allow us to bring you more episodes. Thank you, see you next time.